Yeah, talking about eufy.com. The Eufy video lock is unbelievable. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Best Buy stores starting on May 20th. What is it? It's a smart lock, 2K cam, and doorbell, 3-in-1, triple security, so you can have everything you need in one device rather than install many pieces on your front door. It's not just for security, but also for convenience. No more concerns about losing keys like my wife. You can assign passwords to your family members and see them coming back home via the integrated camera. It's easy to install and set up with just a Phillips head screwdriver, no drilling required. It's got a keyless entry. No more fumbling for the keys. When hands are full, never worry about kids losing keys or passing among the renters of your house. You got a rental property out there, this is a must-have. I love this product. Just got it a couple weeks ago. Huge fan. Have the Ring camera. It's okay. It's not as great as this, so I swapped it out. Go to Eufy Video Lock today on YouTube. That's EUFY Video Lock, or visit EUFYOfficial.com/video lock to see how you can gain complete control of your front door.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Welcome to Drinking Bros Podcast. Another day, another wild guest here. David Epstein, control yourself. My man, you are bursting through the screen right now.
I'll try. I'm sorry. I don't want to be too bright for your camera.
No.
Just blow the whole thing out.
Yeah, and I don't want to wait for our lives to be over, so let's do this. That's right.
Yeah.
Because Ross is back in Wilmington. We're throwing a little street cred back to Dawson's Creek and shit, man. That's our roots back there.
It is. Wilmington, North Carolina is where I'm at today, David. Got displaced from the storm. Lost the first floor of my house, so they had to. They're currently in there, cutting out the first 2 feet of drywall around, and that should be done sometime tomorrow afternoon. Pipes burst, David,
okay.
6 to be exact, and it really nukes out everything. Where you're like, holy shit, I can't believe that happened.
Yes, yeah. You know, never appreciate them working until they're not.
Right. It's well, that's why we have roman.com/drinkingbros as a sponsor. They do ED pills.
They do.
That's right.
They do.
We're professionals here, goddammit.
That was a very deft.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome for that. David, you're a multiple New York Times best-selling author. What I find fascinating is they're in books that are completely, entirely different to one another. The first one is Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. And how did you get Bill Gates to write about this book is what I don't understand.
I also don't understand, to be honest. I'll give you everything I know, which is in 2014. So my first book was called The Sports Gene.
Uh-huh.
And the books are actually related, and I can explain that even though it seems like they're not. But I gave a TED talk about why, like, athletic records are getting better faster than humans could be evolving as a species. And like several years later, he tweeted about it saying, hey, look at all the progress that I talk about. Cause you know, he'll highlight a lot of data that shows we're really, you know, things are getting better on a global scale, but people don't really recognize that in all sorts of ways. And he's tweeted about it saying, like, look, this is kind of an analogy to what I talk about in some other areas, this progress that's been happening in sports. And so I knew I was on his radar. And when my next book was coming out, I sort of sent some copies over to the Gates Foundation saying, you know, here's some spots I think he might be interested in. And I knew he has this bag. You ever seen like the documentary about him? He has a literal bag that people
have
books in because he's like a voracious reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have no idea if it got in that bag. Nothing for like a year and a half. Then I noticed it popped up on his Goodreads and said, well, that's probably the last I'll hear of it. He's probably going to give me like 2 stars. And then around Christmas, he wrote this whole big review of it. Like, And as far as I'm concerned, this settles the longstanding question of whether Bill Gates is a clever guy. You know, he's obviously smart enough to.
Yeah, it's just so weird that, you know, you don't think a guy like that has time to not only read this much, but then to single your book out in particular. I mean, did it blow your mind where you're just like, holy shit, I can't believe this happened?
Yeah, I mean, by the way, speaking of his reading, like if you go look at his Goodreads, he reads extremely fast. He reads a lot. And someone sent me like a congratulatory text and I was like, thanks, man, what did I do? And he was like, oh, like Google you and Bill Gates. And I'm like, oh, Google Bill Gates and Epstein. That's probably not actually going to be like content. but it was good news, you know, and I was especially gratified by it because I've read like several biographies of Steve Jobs. And one of my main conclusions was how smart Bill Gates is. So, yeah, I don't know. It was very unexpected and cool.
Jobs was a good marketer, right?
He was a brilliant guy, too. It's just for someone who was like in some ways his chief rival to come across as thoughtful and bright as he does in books about Jobs. It's impressive. You know, I mean, not Steve Jobs also, obviously they're geniuses in different ways, but I didn't expect that to come out of reading about Steve Jobs.
Gun to head, you've got to choose one: Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. Who is the most brilliant?
Well, obviously, I mean, it was pretty much a tiebreaker. And then when Bill Gates, I realized he had such good taste in books, like that broke the tie. So
since we're chatting about him, let's continue on here. He's been taking a lot of heat for some of the statements regarding vaccines and all this other stuff. Where are you at with that as far as Bill Gates goes?
Vaccines are good. I'm pretty unequivocal on that. And I think he's done, I got involved in something called the Convalescent Plasma Project when COVID started, where it was this effort to take blood plasma from people who have developed antibodies because they're recovering and give it to people who still need it. And actually, the NBA turned out to be a huge help with that in a way, because they started having these positive tests early. And we reached out to them saying, like, you know, if any of your players are willing to donate plasma, maybe they could say that publicly. And so like Marcus Smart did and Doris Burke, you know, and that generated this huge amount of publicity. And I started learning a lot about vaccines and infectious disease. And I will say one thing I learned is that the Gates Foundation's efforts around the world to get people vaccinated have made an enormous difference to public health on the global scale. So I didn't realize the impact that they'd had on the global scale until I sort of dove into that a little bit.
Yeah, because, you know, the last time I heard him speak, he was on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, right? I don't know if you caught that interview with him. And he was talking about that we possibly might need a third vaccination in reference to, I believe it was Pfizer who's got the first two. You know, you've got to get two shots. And he was like, you might need a third later on down the line. You know, you study science and athletes and people's bodies for a living and the inner workings of them. How is this different than a flu shot where, you know, a flu shot is protective of, I think, 50%. It's got a 50% success rate. Most of these vaccinations right now for COVID are hovering right around 75 to 85. Why should we get it, I guess? Why is this not just another flu shot?
It may end up looking like another flu shot. You know, maybe the kind of thing where you get the sort of booster every year. I think we don't really know yet. I think the good news is probably that, you know, there's been this question of why in some parts of the developing world are they not having the same, you know, death rates that we're having, like in the United States and in the UK. And I know some hypotheses for that as well, they're just not counting well. But others are that they've actually had more exposure to coronaviruses when they're younger. And so that even if they get this one, it's less likely to be lethal.
Right.
And so I think the hope is that even if you don't have more shots down the line, you know, having had some exposure in one way or another will at least make it less likely to, right, you know, land you in the hospital.
Yep.
But I think it remains to be seen if this ends up being the kind of thing that, you know, maybe we even add to the flu shot every year.
Right. Well, I mean, look, the WHO would disagree with you as of a couple of months ago because they don't believe that exposure is a contributor to herd immunity anymore, apparently. They straight up say that on the website. That's fucking stupid, by the way. And the reason that internationally probably people aren't dying the same way they are here is because America's fat as fuck. Let's be real, right? I mean, 78% of the people reported to be hospitalized from June onward were obese. 78%. That's not even a debate to be had anymore. If you're fat, you're more likely to get any disease, or at least to suffer worse from it than, you know, an otherwise healthy person would.
Yeah, or particularly diabetic, because I mean, I think there are people who are overweight but who exercise a lot and would be, you know, if you looked at other physiological markers, they'd be healthier than someone who is not overweight but does, has very low physical activity.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
You know, I think there's still a lot of stuff that we're gonna, like, because of the amount of news, I think people sort of underestimate how much stuff there is still to learn that we're going to be learning in retrospect for quite a long time about this.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to say. I mean, you seem pretty, I'm in favor of vaccination, but there's a typical process for this, and the process exists for a reason. It's a 5 to 10 year period, not 6 months. So you're talking about how little we know about this, and then people are asking you and sometimes kind of pressuring you under some kind of moral, ethical grounds that you should do this thing, and we don't even know what the fuck the long-term effects might be. That is an absolutely ridiculous thing to ask of people.
But I think there are, so let's say, so sort of one basic principle is, like, when you have something that has a small effect, so let's say if you have a medication that has, like, a subtle effect, makes you a little bit better, it takes a really big study or potentially a really long study in order to pick up a small effect, to separate what's the real signal from the noise. If it's a large effect, then it doesn't take that long of a study or that big of a study. And these initial vaccines have had such a large effect, much bigger than I expected, that I'd say that it's appropriate in some ways to have, like, not needed as long a process as we normally do. When things have big effects, you can pick them up more easily.
For sure, yeah.
It's been a pleasant surprise in this case.
In this case, but it's only for a very small subsection of the population, right? We're talking about people that are truly at risk of death from COVID, or it's a very small percentage of the population that are truly at risk. So, even then, we have all these. I've seen a lot of these studies, and I've looked at the demographics of them. They're like mixed advertising, right? Blended advertising, where you're doing, I don't know how much you know about advertising, but if you're targeting top and bottom of the funnel with the same ad, it's going to be extremely inefficient, and you're going to get bad data back. It's garbage in, garbage out data, basically. So I think in the same way, if we're applying the same standard to people who are in low risk categories to high risk categories, that's a problem. Now, when you're talking about herd immunity, that's a whole other situation, right? Because it requires you to blend everybody together. So,
yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's just how it is. I mean, this is a very, you're right, there's a lot of noise, particularly from the media, which is pretty much all you hear from the media is noise anymore. And I think the average person is having a hard time separating that out. And Fauci doesn't help, because he says different shit from day to day sometimes, if not week to week. We've had really bad leadership from pretty much everybody involved in this conversation. We've had bad leadership so far. I think people are fucking losing their minds. They're tired of being locked up, and now they're given this opportunity to be vaccinated so they can go back and do stuff. Maybe, I don't know, but it seems like there's a lot of noise and not a lot of real information that people can get, at least not consumable information for the average person.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously one of, like, the challenges of this moment in time in general, is kind of separating the good information from the bad information. For me, I think this vaccine research, it looks way better and more solid than I expected it to. And there's some things you can do. Like, let's say, obviously, some of the probably most familiar narrative that people have about vaccines, you know, not being good relates to autism and increased rates.
Oh, that's so stupid, though.
And I would say, like, you could look at, so they say, okay, as vaccination has increased, autism has increased, and that is true. But what you want to, you could also say, okay, if then what you should see is that not being vaccinated should have a protective effect against autism,
which is certainly not the case. Yeah,
and when you look at populations that aren't vaccinated, you don't see a protective effect against autism. So that is clearly not the cause.
No, it's correlation and causation, obviously. I mean, So I mean, and with the vaccines, people will be like, it's confirmation bias at its worst. People will see, like, older folks dying after getting the vaccine and be like, see, fucking told you. Like, I mean, that person was probably going to die anyways, to be honest, if they got exposed to it, because their immune system was that compromised. Otherwise, a smaller version of the virus would not have just murdered them like that. You know what I mean? That's a reasonable conclusion to come to, but you only come to reasonable conclusions when you're trying to come to a reasonable conclusion and not trying to prove your own point. And we have completely, we're we're the dumbest motherfuckers of all time in this country right now. We have all the information you could possibly want. And instead of everybody getting together like, oh, we got all this information, let's sort through this and find some shit. Everybody's like, no, this is my information. You can get fucked, motherfucker. I'm like, all right, dude, just relax. Yeah. Let's try to, because we all got to survive and live and shit. So we should probably work together at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a problem. Like, if you look back at, you know, like kind of early 90s research on like stuff related to climate change, at the time, it wasn't, beliefs weren't drawn along political lines. And in other countries, they still aren't, where that hasn't become sort of a political issue. So I think as soon as something becomes like politicized, people's beliefs tend to, they tend to change their beliefs rather than change their parties, so to speak. And I think there's been a lot of that going on in every direction.
Well, speaking of all that, partisanship, you do a lot of sports stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like you write about, you've written about a number of sports related things. One of the most interesting to our audience is going to be the neuroscience of like why somebody is good in crunch time versus why somebody else is not, and what the neuroscience behind that looks like. Now, you've written a book on this, right?
I mentioned it in my book, and okay. I just took over the Slate's How To podcast. Mm. And so, of course, immediately used it for my own interests.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And had the first episode, because the way the show works is a listener writes in with some kind of problem and or question, and we take them and pair them, match them with someone with relevant experience or expertise, and I kind of moderate between them, and then we distill the wisdom. And so this woman wrote in who was a real estate agent. You know, she was in like this very competitive area of real estate, and she had also, after being like a varsity tennis player, decided to take up like serious tennis again sort of in middle age, and was actually quite good, but was choking all the time and losing to people who were worse than her. And so we brought on this woman whose work I've admired for a long time, named Sion Bylock. And she's a neuroscientist who studies choking. Like, some of her famous studies, she would take you know, elite golfers like into her lab, have them putting, and, you know, then she would give them things like a putter that basically weighed exactly the same but had like a little kink in it or something, and their performance would totally deteriorate. Basically, the biology, the neuroscience that's underlying this is like, when you practice something a lot, like think about riding a bike, for example, at first you have to think about exactly what you're doing, or driving, right? Like hand over hand. And then as you get better, that moves out of your prefrontal cortex, like the part of your brain that's there for like higher thinking and focus and all this. And it just happens automatically. And now you can, you know.
Yeah. This is why, by the way, I take mushrooms recreationally, because it does it. I'm not even kidding. It does that. What you're talking about, if you've read books like Stealing Fire or The Rise of Superman or some of these other books, you'll find. We actually have Kyler Steven on the show Friday. If you look into this stuff, it's doing essentially what people experience when they're in the zone, from in sports vernacular, right? You can if you do the right kind of, if you do things the right way, you can create that unnaturally, right? So you can make that happen in your brain without having to go through some of that stuff. Now, there's some pretty good studies actually that I've read recently that show you can condense to learn a conversational language. For a relatively smart person, you're looking at about 6 months of really intense work, right? With using psilocybin and some other stuff, they've been able to use some studies to reduce people down to about 6 weeks to learn conversational, like a romantic language, you know what I mean? Not moving to a different alphabet or anything like that, but for an English speaker to learn French or Spanish, for example, you can reduce that for the same reason, right? You're shutting down on the frontal cortex stimulus, like the shower principle, right? You're in the shower fucking doing mechanical tasks, and all of a sudden, bright idea. It's always made sense. We just couldn't put our finger on it until relatively recently, and people really started studying how the brain works. And I find this stuff fascinating.
I didn't know any of it at work. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
David, I knew you were studying choking. Did you guys do a study on the entire city of Atlanta by any chance? Because that's all of my favorite teams. And I wonder if the city has something to do with their choking constantly, over and over and over again.
We didn't. No area specific study that I know of.
I'm just making sure it wasn't like the varsity or something like that, where it was like, oh man, the varsity is too close to all the stadiums. That type of food is horrific for you.
No, but you know, sorry, go ahead.
For not running the ball in the fourth quarter of a, let's say, a Super Bowl when you're up 20.
Yeah, but that wasn't in Atlanta.
No, I know, but they were clearly on the flight from Atlanta to Houston that day. So
And there, there should be like a positive cycle of choking, right? So the thing that happens is once you've taken all that stuff out of your prefrontal cortex and automated it, so you don't have to think about it anymore. When you choke is when you bring it back into your prefrontal cortex. Like if you were, so you know how to ride a bike, presumably, and you'd be fine. You wouldn't have to think about it. You could do it with no hands, except if I put you on like a narrow ledge on a mountain pass, suddenly you would not feel like you could do that. You'd be thinking a lot and you might de-automate that process and perform worse. And so there actually is like a positive feedback cycle of choking that leads to more choking, because then you think about the choking.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you don't want to be doing is thinking. And so there should be choking clusters, basically.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, like Chuck Knobloch, for example.
Absolutely.
Or the yips in general, right?
Yeah.
Just the yips in general. So John Smoltz went to a psychiatrist in between 90 and 92, really, when he came over from the Tigers to the Braves and went through that whole fucking process. Zach Greinke went through the same thing, right? Sometime, actually, after he won his first Cy Young Award, he had to go through all that stuff. So I wonder if, I haven't had the opportunity to read the neuroscientist you were talking about, any of their other work, but did they write anything on the corrective part of that, where they're trying to, you know, build schema inside the brain to protect from that shit happening? Because, you know, I'm sure sports psychiatrists have been doing that for years, but I haven't seen a whole lot of the work on it. I'm just curious.
Yeah, she wrote a book called Choke that's like really
Didn't Chuck Palahniuk write a book called Choke as well? Probably different, a little bit different, yeah.
Probably different kind of choke. Because Choke was probably, yeah. But she did. Sion Bylock wrote a book called Choke, and in it, you know, she definitely has strategies, because basically the most basic thing. So I would say probably three of the core practices are low stakes practice, right? Mm-hmm. You should try to get in this atmosphere in some time where it doesn't matter as much, right? Like whether it's public speaking or whatever. Cognitive outsourcing, which is like you get like a mantra or something that when you feel yourself starting to choke.
So mindfulness, saying, right?
Mindfulness, but specifically, instead of just tuning into your brain, you actually want to tune into something else. Mm. It's like you could like write a mantra on your hand. And you look at that when you feel yourself starting to choke, because you want to interrupt it, basically. You want to occupy your prefrontal cortex with something else. So also like singing or counting backwards, that kind of stuff. So interrupting, occupying your prefrontal cortex in some other way. So have you ever seen like, what's his name? Idan Ravine. He was like this ball handling guru for like a bunch of NBA players. He was once in a commercial where like Carmelo is doing some drills and you see a guy like throwing tennis balls at him.
Yeah. I've seen that. Yep.
And so he's like this sort of ball handling guru. I think he started with Steve Francis, but then worked with a whole bunch of other guys. And I think what he figured out intuitively, because I saw him doing some of his drills, is to just come up with stuff that would occupy someone's prefrontal cortex while they were trying to learn the skill.
Right.
And that's sort of part of the trick. So I don't think he was like, I mean, I talked to him about it after, he wasn't like steeped in the neuroscience, but I think he just intuitively, you know, was a genius.
Right, but that's what I was saying before with the, like, we've known about the concept of the shower principle forever, and people have been over the last, what, probably since the boomer generation, trying to find ways to distract themselves so they can come get the breakthrough points, whether you want to call it, even in groups with group flow and stuff like that. People have been trying to do that before. The neuroscience has now caught up and explained why that was working, I guess. So you can move it forward now. So you can actually come up with strategies instead of just trying random shit.
That's a great point, though, because honestly, this, I think there's a misperception in many cases about how sports science works, that it's like, oh, you know, elite athletes have all this like tech and magic. Most of the time, the vast majority of the time, someone, a coach or an athlete, tries something, and then retrospectively, sports scientists are like, well, that's why that worked. Mm-hmm. And then you can apply it more broadly. I mean, even basic shit. Like, think of, you know, one of the most famous like disruptive innovations would be the Fosbury flop, you know, going over a high jump bar backwards.
Right.
Right. At the time, everyone told Dick Fosbury, like, that's ridiculous. You're going to go over backwards. Like, you can't see where you're going. It works because when he curls, you know, like put your body in like a C, your center of mass can cross under the bar because it's in the middle of that C while you go over. So you don't have to jump as high. But it took him doing that and like, you know, becoming a world champion. And then scientists were like, well, of course that works because, whereas everybody told him. So it's often that the athletes and coaches actually do this sort of experimentation and it's explained
retrospectively. So let's look at one of the best, at least most successful athletes of all time, Michael Jordan. He routinely would create drama that wasn't actually there. Like he would intentionally take things personally. So now I wonder, after all this research, was it the extra endorphins from being motivated by his anger or hatred for these people, or was just focusing on that anger and hatred really getting in the way of him thinking about what he's doing? He just goes out there and excels as an athlete. You know what I mean? That's a really good question to ask.
Yeah. And I don't know for him particularly, but there is this whole big sports science literature about like your level of arousal, basically. So, and you can see this in some of people's brain chemistry. Like some people need to be jacked up before a game to get to peak performance, or before a test or whatever. It's basically like, you can picture like an inverted U curve, right? You want to get here. You want to get like your brain chemistry here for peak performance. And some people need to get jacked up to get there because they're just mellow or whatever normally. And other people are like almost right there. And when the pressure's on, they're coming down the other side. And it turns out that for some people, anger is like a really useful, you know, you think of like, oh, you should never want to be angry. But in fact, it turns out to be like an excellent for certain people for reaching their level of arousal. It just determines what kind of, you know, depends what kind of person you are in the start.
But that makes sense though, right? Because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if it's the anger or if it whatever it is. I mean, we think about things in the terms of the stimulus rather than the outcome. And it seems like, at least in sports neuroscience, it's been far more productive for us to start with the result and work our way backwards, right? Because we understand a lot about the brain. We understand a lot about the results from sports because it's mostly, some of it's anecdotal, but a lot of it is actually hard data driven. So that's two good data pools to work with right there.
Yeah, and sports are a lot more easily measurable than a lot of, like, I think it's, you know, I think there's a reason analytics revolution in large part comes out of baseball, right? It's like so many discrete things that are happening that you can record and track, and so it's a lot easier. You know, whereas even in sports like soccer or something, it's been trickier, never mind like broader life.
Right. Who's the author of that neuroscience book you were talking about a minute ago?
Sian Bialik.
It's okay.
Yeah, her first name is S-I-A-N, last name B-E-I-L-O-C-K.
Yeah, there's an actress with that last name, and I was wondering if it was the same person because they both studied neuroscience.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Blossom is her name.
Oh, yeah. They're spelled a little differently. Yeah.
Okay. I was like, hey, man. Yeah. I was like, are we talking about fucking Blossom?
No.
I mean, she's brilliant, and she wrote a book about neuroscience, but I was like, Jesus Christ.
No.
I didn't know we were going all in on Blossom today. That would have been rad.
No, Sian Bialik's a college president, not an actress.
Yeah. if it was, it would have been
that
nuts.
Would have been yeah. I would have mentioned that though.
I feel like you would have been.
Some people don't, and I'm like, hey, I just want to fact check this, that we're not talking about fucking Blossom today. That'd be a weird day. With you, I mean, look, you've had such an interesting life. Is it true you were the one who broke the Alex Rodriguez steroid scandal in 03?
Yeah, I co-wrote it in it was in 09. He tested positive in 03 when we wrote the story in 09. Yeah, with Selena Roberts, my colleague, yeah.
So the 03 test, was that part of the Mitchell reporting testing? Or because a lot of that stuff got leaked, it wasn't supposed to, but a lot of the people that showed up on the Mitchell report, there were more people on the report than there were tests given. So we know some of those names were for other reasons, like nefarious connections and blah, 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 whatever, right?
Right, there was like this sort of like intel gathering operation.
Yeah.
For Alex, it was tests that were, like, I'll try to give the quick history here.
Sure.
When baseball was getting dragged in front of Congress, and Congress folk were saying, you know, they were like grandstanding and doing their thing and saying like, hey, either you guys are going to get this steroid problem under control, or we're going to do it for you. And the agreement was made that they would do survey testing in the majors and minors.
Right.
This was the agreement with the union to get Congress off their back, and they said, if at least 5% of guys test positive, then we'll implement, you know, like normal testing in a normal season. And if they don't, then we don't have to do that. And thinking that, like, there's no way guys know when the test is coming. There's no way 5% of guys are going to fail tests when they know it's coming.
Right.
And they had underestimated, especially in the minors, how many guys were using, and more than 5% of guys failed. Those were all anonymized tests, purely for surveys, names separated from the test results. But the union was planning to challenge the test results. And so they kept them around when they were supposed to be destroyed. Meanwhile, in some stuff involved in the Balco investigation, some investigators came and seized some records from a lab that were related to Balco, not to these other people, but they ended up seizing a computer that also had all of those other preserved tests. And basically that meant that they stayed around long after they were supposed to get
destroyed. Well, that's in investigative terms, that's called fruit of the poison tree, and it's supposed to be inadmissible and non-publishable. But hey, you know what? No one really cares about that shit.
It's not non-publishable for a magazine. It might be.
No, exactly. Right. Yeah. Court, exactly. Right? Yeah.
It ended up leading to a really important case where the government. So they were only looking for like data on 10 people, but they seized the whole computers. And so the question was, are you allowed to, if you go into like a drug dealer's house or something, you get their ledger, you're only looking for one person, you're allowed to take
correct
information on 100 other people. Yep. But in this case, ultimately it was like appealed several times, and they decided that you couldn't do it the same way with digital records, or else you could be looking for like one Verizon customer and seize the whole country.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
exactly.
It ended up being kind of an interesting case.
It is. Yeah.
That's so wild. Well, in your opinion, what was the most fascinating thing that you found when doing that report in particular that you didn't think in a million years would be in there?
Doing the drug stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Good question. The most fascinating thing I found, probably at the time, this feels like second nature to me now, but at the time that these systems, well, first of all, that athletes are like a tiny piece of like this, the steroid and performance enhancing drug industry runs not on athletes at all. It's on people who want to look better.
Right.
But that whole industry didn't work without like doctors and scientists. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like cartels doing that, right? It was people with MDs and PhDs. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't have worked the same way without them. And at the time, to me, that was, now that seems like a given, but at the time that was very surprising.
But that's a whole industry now. I mean, TRT in particular is an entire industry, and it's growing, I would say, very rapidly.
I think some pretty big social questions, because like something like, I think the number of men in their 40s who have a testosterone prescription, it like quintupled from like 2000 to 2010. So you may end up in a situation where you have athletes playing into their 40s, where most of their non-athlete peers have prescriptions for testosterone replacement, but they can't. Yeah, I mean, you could end up with some interesting intersections of sports and
I wonder if, I know there have been several pretty good studies done on the effects of testosterone in particular in baseball, right? Mm-hmm. As far as players hitting the ball farther or harder with more force or whatever. Recovery time is obviously one of the things that was at the top, so less prone to injury and greater recovery time. So a lot of the people in the minor leagues that tested positive during that Mitchell report were actually pitchers. I think it was a higher percentage of pitchers than position players. One of the things, so Brinkus talks about this a lot. One of the things they found is that the biggest effect was vision, right? So players' vision became very acute when they were on these drugs. Barry Bonds in particular, his vision increased like from 2015, which is great, to 2010, which is crazy, right? So he could see the ball better. So they weren't hitting the ball farther, but they were making hard contact more often than they weren't before, right? I always wondered about, I mean, it's too bad that it was just from a science perspective that it was so controversial that we couldn't actually get good data and look into it. Like test all the top players, right? Take the top 50 people in home runs, RBI and batting average, and test all of them. Say, and you could look at who was doing what at what level. Like, well, this guy's clearly has elevated testosterone and he's doing this versus somebody who clearly wasn't taking testosterone, but we're still doing the same thing. What is the effect? I mean, you've done some work. I don't know about research, but you've definitely done some writing on TRT and hormone therapy with transgender people, especially. That all is fascinating to me, how we draw these weird lines. So it's and another thing about that is the way you even framed the statement before, where Congress saw it as there's a problem with steroids in baseball. The problem was it was the most exciting period for baseball in my lifetime, right? So I'm not sure what the problem was. I mean, as long as people are being safe and using the drugs responsibly, I don't really give a shit, frankly.
I mean, when I went back to Congress years later, you know, when they were doing the Roger Clemens stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe being more naive about these things than I am now, they had a day, they were going to talk about growth hormone, you know, and they had a day before where there were like some of the world's experts in growth hormone came in to testify. And I went there to listen to that. And there were like, you know, a lot of the committee didn't even show up. And then the next day the baseball players came and the cameras came and the lines are out the door and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, it was pretty telling that like, were they interested in learning about growth hormone? Not so much.
And that's funny because they all showed up to all the testosterone stuff. I mean, just from a medical perspective, HGH is way more problematic than testosterone. There's a lot of stuff that can happen with high blood pressure and vessel constriction and things like that with higher TRT that you need to really keep an eye on, but and heart disease as well, from an enlarged heart and things like that. But HGH makes everything in your body larger, even cancer, right? So if you've got like something going on in your body, a tumor that even if it's benign, but it's going to be a blockage at some point, you're taking HGH and it's not seen, you're not getting a full body scan. Because most of the people I know that take Sermorelin and HGH and things like that, that Sermorelin produces, helps you produce more natural HGH. They're not, they get blood tests done, but that's not enough for this, right? If you have like polyps or cysts or any kind of shit like that, it's getting bigger. That's the way that shit works.
Yeah, I mean, I know one of the theories for why, you know, younger, you usually think of younger people as being more able to cope with any type of disease, but I think one of the theories for why young women are often have, if they get breast cancer, progresses very quickly is because they have more growth hormone. I don't know that that's proven, but I know that was a at least a sensible theory.
Right. Maybe, yeah. I mean, but conversely, one of the drugs that you get when for the AIDS cocktail is HGH, right? So there's some immunity to it, right? But if it's making cancer, if it's metastasizing cancer, that's a whole other fucking issue. So maybe there's not a good answer there.
Yeah, and also, I mean, if you're getting medicated for HIV, right, you're already like balancing the risk of the
right,
stuff
of course,
you're taking
yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah. But that particular cocktail is pretty goddamn successful. I mean, it's well beyond what I ever thought it would be, which is great.
David, you've got your own podcast. You know, we got some sponsors to put this shit wagon on the air. First and foremost is ghostbed.com/drinking bros. I know I've said it a bunch of times the last couple months. 40% off a bundle package when you get an adjustable base, or you get 30% off if you put the promo code drinking bros off of everything at checkout, like if you want individual items. Now there's a new twist. Ghostbed is saying that anyone who gets a ghost bed product, a mattress, an adjustable base, some sheets or whatever, if you take a picture of yourself in the ghost bed and put it up on Instagram, tag at ghost bed, tag their Instagram, and then put hashtag drinking bros next to it, they're going to send you 2 free pillows. Now, the pillows are just as good as the goddamn bed, and they're pretty pricey for a reason. They last for a very long time, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, it's when somebody gives you a 20-year guarantee on a fucking mattress, that's a pretty big, bold statement, I believe.
Yeah, and I dude, if memory serves me correct, I think the pillows are guaranteed for like 5 years, which is a fucking miracle.
Yeah, I mean, I can't. It's all the stuff they do, it seems wild to me. The 36-month pay-as-you-go program, things like that is... Hey, I mean, I'm not going to turn it down. I'll tell you that. I'm going to take advantage. I have taken advantage of it a number of times, as a matter of fact. We use our own codes for everything, guys. Sorry to all the sponsors out there, but we're definitely using our own codes. So, I don't know what to tell you.
Go to ghostbed.com/drinking bros today to cash in on all these deals. And then, obviously, there is a 36-month pay-as-you-go program. No interest at ghostbed.com, because why the fuck not? If you're going to have all those other deals, you might as well have this. Go to ghostbed.com/drinking bros today. Couple all those deals with their 36-month pay-as-you-go program, no interest, and you're out of there at like $40, $35 a month with a whole new bedroom set. Next up, we got liquidiv.com. Promo code drinking bros gets you 25% off.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony, I'm drinking it right now.
So am I. I'm actually drinking it out of this sweet ass little double container they gave me, but I got to tell you, I've been loading up on Liquid IV all day today because we're going out to dinner with Jesse tonight. You know how she likes to party.
Yep, yep. She likes to party. And then, shit, man, St. Patrick's Day is just around the bend.
That's true.
Load
yeah.
up on that.
Yeah, that's true.
People are getting rocked. I have a feeling I'll be drinking those all morning Thursday as well.
I mean, this is really the first big national holiday, I guess, since COVID standards have started to relax in a lot of states. So this is probably going to be a wild one, folks.
I take Martin Luther King Day very seriously, Dan, but whatever, that's just me.
Yeah, but most people don't get blackout drunk for Martin Luther King Day.
I do.
Well, let's
I
do
celebrate
it.
All of our historical figures by getting blackout drunk, and I'm not going to apologize for it. With one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water, you get 2 to 3 times the amount of hydration as plain water. They've got a bunch of flavors that are incredible, like watermelon, lemon, lime, passion fruits, and they recently launched the strawberry. So if you're just imagining a freshly picked taste of ripe, juicy strawberries topped with decadent notes of whipped cream. That's what it tastes like. It's amazing. Grab your strawberry liquid IV or their other great flavors in bulk at nationwide at Costco if you want to, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the promo code DRINKINBROS at checkout. It's 25% off everything when you order and use the promo code DRINKINBROS at liquidiv.com. Get better hydration today at liquidiv.com. Promo code DRINKINBROS. Next up, Dan, is the reason why we drink Liquid IVs, because we're drinking too much fucking wine.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. I actually just got a delivery this morning of First Leaf. 6 new bottles to enjoy. I love this place so much. Every month when my new shipment comes in, I'm always really excited to see, because I actually go through, because I enjoy wine so much, and I enjoy knowing about it almost as much as I enjoy it. So I like filling out the cards and reviewing everything and seeing what their next move is. Like, I'm not that I'm trying to trip them up or anything, but if you go through the process where you answer the question, you take a quiz, answer a few brief questions, and then kind of go through some of the taste and flavor profiles that you like, maybe some of the wines you tried before, and you get that first batch. Now, even if you're not into all this geeked out shit, you get that first batch. It's fucking 6 bottles of wine for $30. You're not getting that anywhere else, folks. Not with good wine anyway. You can get it with shitty wine at a gas station or something, but you're not getting, these are really top quality wines.
Oh yeah, dude. Shit. My shipment came to my now one story house. Jesse was there picking out paint or something. And she's got it in her car. So, if you see her tonight, she's got my 6 pack this month in the car. Tell her not to drink that before I get into town on Wednesday.
That's going to be gone.
Go to tryfirstleaf.com/drinkingbros. The deal is real. 6 bottles for $29.95 and free shipping. So discover new wine like a VIP by becoming a First Leaf member. Join today and you'll get 6 bottles of wine for $29.95 and free shipping. Just go to tryfirstleaf.com/drinkingbros. 6 bottles of wine for $29.95 and free shipping at tryfirstleaf.com/drinkingbros. Last up, D'Anthony, who do we got?
We've got HelloFresh. So after you've got your wine, you want to pair it with some food. You still eat food, right?
Me?
Yeah,
barely.
You're not just on the booze, you're eating food as well.
Barely anymore, Dan. And I'll tell you this, man, during that fucking snowstorm in Texas, there was one thing that made it through the ice and sleet and everything else. Swear to God, it was HelloFresh. I took a box of it.
Oh, yeah.
I took a picture of the box outside.
Yeah, I have actually, when all the food places shut down, I had a bunch of HelloFresh left over for my last shipment. So that's the first thing I ate over those days. And it's good. I mean, that's obviously an extreme example, but the whole point of the program, the whole point of the company is to make your life a little bit more convenient. Everybody eats. People want to more and more these days eat healthy food that is convenient to make, right? And this is the best way to do it, in our opinion.
Easily, man. It's 10 to 20 minute meals, low prep recipes. And I've been eating it for a year and a half. This was actually a sponsor that I phoned in. And I was just like, hey, man, I'm eating this shit every day. Like, and I love it. Can we just kind of pop me on over onto the thing? It's great, man. It's the number one meal kit in America for a reason. This deal, though, it feels like they just keep getting more and more intense. And I don't know how they're making money, but I love it. You go to HelloFresh.com/drinkingbros12. That's HelloFresh.com/drinkingbros12. Use the code drinkingbros12 for free. I'm going to say this once again, for free. They're all free.
Right.
12 meals.
Including shipping.
Free shipping. They're just literally giving you 12 meals for free and free shipping.
Now, what do you know about marketing, where we talked about this with some other companies before? Somebody's literally willing to give you their product for free, just like, hey, here it is for free. The assumption that they're making is our product is so good that they will buy it after we give them free shit. Now, that is a bold statement to make, but they wouldn't be making it, a company of this size, unless it is proved to be demonstrably true over time. That means you really don't have an option, right? If you're in any way in the market for anything like this, you've got to try this, because the product speaks for itself. Being able to give something away free and get you to buy it again is the ultimate test of a marketing campaign. And that's what they've been doing for some time now. So let's do this.
Yeah. So go to HelloFresh.com/DrinkinBros12. Use the promo code DrinkinBros12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. That is HelloFresh.com/DrinkinBros12. Use the code DrinkinBros12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. America's number one meal kit. I eat it every single day, David. I do.
So you're talking about now we're talking about body chemistry and things like that, and age groups. So one of the things that you've spoken about before is how we have this weird, probably incorrect concept of how athletes age. Yeah. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think people have this idea that athletes, you know, they sort of like expire in their late 20s. And, and there are things that change, no question about it. But I was curious. I mean, my hypothesis was that we would see more athletes as sort of, you know, coaches learned more and sports scientists helped them learn more, that we would see more athletes like playing into their early, mid and late 40s. Mm. I don't think we'll see like the average age of elite athletes change that much, because most athletes probably go when someone who is nearly as good as them but younger and cheaper comes.
Correct. Yeah.
But if it's not an issue of them having expired, but if they're, you know, if they're really good, they can play a lot longer. And that has shown up in a whole bunch of, you know, in the pro leagues and in the Olympics, that we've seen more of these older outliers. Right. And I think the fact is, like, to a certain extent, like, this is sounds stupid, but to a certain extent, aging is a bit of a choice, you know, like when you get to like 70, things fall off. Right, yeah. But otherwise there's all this like compensatory stuff you can do. Like one thing that everyone who exercises probably notices, that as they get older, their maximum heart rate comes down, right? So you can't move as much blood. But there's like fascinating research, one on this, a rower who medaled in 5 straight Olympics, showing that happened to him too. But if he kept working out in certain ways, it just expanded one of the chambers of his heart enough that each pump was bigger, so it just compensated. There's all this compensatory stuff that happens. And there's an analysis of every Major League Baseball player, just basically for a century, who had played at least 10 seasons. Mm. And there's a pretty natural aging curve. And you know, hitters are usually starting to decline around 29, which also, by the way, is when eyesight
exactly. Yeah, yeah, yep.
And that said, so, you know, some people did better than others, and there was often this compensation where like on base percentage would go up to compensate for other things, like they became more selective about pitches and all this stuff. And there's this huge amount of compensation that I think we don't give enough credit for. And simple aspects of sports and exercise science that have entered sports more, like so-called periodization, right? When I was, one of the first things I did when I was at Sports Illustrated was I got sent to Lions training camp, and I'm there.
Detroit Lions,
yeah.
Eesh, and, man, were you on punishment or possibly suspended?
Well, I said it was one of the first things I did. You don't walk in and like you get to go to like the plum assignment, right? You go where Peter King doesn't want to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Detroit's definitely on that list.
And so I was there, and I'm like looking at this, you know, roster, whatever, and I'm looking at these guys, and I'm like, this guy, one of their star players, I'm like, these guys are like 30 to 50 pounds heavier than it says on this like piece of paper that they just handed me. And so what I saw with some of them, at least, was that they were getting like their asses kicked. You know, they're like, they're out of shape from the offseason. We need to kick their asses. And it's like, there's this huge body of science. And again, something called periodization, which is like, that's the exact wrong way to do it. Like, that might feel like the way to do it, like kick their ass because they're out of shape. But actually, it's like, you should be treating them like they just got out of surgery. They're in terrible shape. And if you need to ease them into it, and you basically build with these periods of increasing stress followed by rest, and then you ramp it up again, and you go in these like cycles.
Right.
That's what periodization is.
Yeah.
And I think that stuff extends people's careers, extends for their sure, seasons, yeah. It extends their careers. You know, I think they were trying to do the thing that they did, like, can't remember the main guy's name in The Princess Bride, where he's like dead and they put him in that machine. They're like, we're going to bring him back to life.
Yeah.
And bring him back to life instantly, but it takes a bunch of years off his life. That's right, like yeah. a lot of what was sort of traditionally seen as like the hard ass, get guys right, into yeah. shape. But it's like,
we've known about that same concept is, it's the, like, if you have a muscle injury, for example, periodization with hot cold treatment and then flexibility treatment, right, has worked. We've been doing that for 100 years, so I don't know why it hasn't made its way into, I know it's because athletics is a business. It's a TV show, right, to sell advertising. That's what it is. So people need to get their best guys back as soon as possible. I understand that.
Yeah, yeah. And it could be. I mean, you could see from a coach's perspective, like, hey, if this doesn't go well and I'm fired in a season or two anyway, then, right. like, their interest may be misaligned in terms of the long term with the athlete's longevity.
Yeah. I mean, the Golden State Warriors got in a little trouble for that. I wouldn't say trouble, but they caught a little heat from bringing back KD after that initial injury. You know what I mean? And then he got hurt again and missed all of last season.
Right. You look at like a Robert Griffin, right? Like there's no if his long-term development had been, you know, the main priority, obviously things would have happened differently.
Yeah, and if he would have, you know, not running so much and gotten trucked a million times, that too. But
that's the other thing. I mean, so you look at someone like Tom Brady, right? You're like, okay, pocket passer. He, the physiological requirements of what he's doing, they don't matter that much for aging for most of them. He's mostly relying on, you know, he's not running around.
Right.
He's relying on perceptual expertise, right? Which is like the reason why, I don't know, maybe this is getting like too much in the weeds, but like, you ever seen the shows where like softball pitchers will strike out Major League Baseball?
Oh, we were just talking about that before the show, actually. Jenny Finch went to the 2002 or 2003 All-Star game and was pitching to Barry Bonds, and he fouled off two balls out of all the ones she hit and didn't touch another one. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I remember the first time I saw that, I'm like, okay, she's throwing 63 from like a 43-foot mound.
Yeah.
Why can't these guys hit it if they have reflexes fast enough to hit 100-mile-per-hour fastballs, you know? And the fact is they don't have reflexes fast enough. They do what skill acquisition scientists call, they form a chunk. Basically, they pick up on body cues from the pitcher, you know, movements of the torso, rotation of the shoulder, all this stuff. Flicker of the pitch, the flashing pattern the seams make when the ball spins. Group it into a chunk. It's one signal. It says ball's going here or there. Swing or don't swing. They have to make that decision as soon as the pitch is released. Because, like, the fastest possible human reaction time to get a signal, electrical signal from your brain to your muscles is 200 milliseconds. That's a fifth of a second. That's half the flight time of the pitch.
Yeah. So like, it's 0.4. For a 95-mile-per-hour fastball, it's 4/10 of a second.
You know, if you like, when we tell kids keep their eye on the ball, you know, we actually can't – you don't have a visual system that's capable of tracking an object that – position changes that close to your face. So like when you tell kids to keep your eye on the ball, that's nonsense. Like you can't do it. They could close their eyes when the ball were halfway in. If it wouldn't like psychologically upset them, it wouldn't make any performance difference. So it's really based on this perceptual expertise of seeing what's coming next. And that gets better with experience and exposure to more sort of different types of problems.
Right.
So meanwhile, Brady is, you know, his arm will get a little weaker, but most of the stuff he does doesn't even require explosiveness or anything like that. And meanwhile, his perceptual expertise shouldn't fade yet anyway.
Yeah, and that's a really good point to make, because today Drew Brees retired, and the difference between them is that Tom Brady's 6'4" and he has giant hands, and Drew Brees is 5'11" maybe if he's wearing cleats, and his hands are much smaller, right? He has to, because of the height of the average NFL lineman on both sides of the ball, has to very frequently get outside of the pocket, even if it's just a couple of feet. And when you lose mobility at 41, 42 years old, and it takes you even a split second longer to get over there, then the route's off, right? Or something. Football is a very specific route-driven game. You have to be where you're supposed to be, when you're supposed to be there. Otherwise, the play's fucked. I mean, if you're Patrick Mahomes, you can run around all day and throw a sidearm halfway down the fucking field. Yeah, but
for now.
But for the majority of people, particularly when they get older, there's no compensatory action for that. You know what I mean? Unless you, I don't know, sign Taysom Hill and let him run half the plays. But now they're going to sign him to a long-term contract. Apparently, I don't know what the fuck's going on in New Orleans.
Well, with Drew Brees, right, he had those little T-Rex arms and he had to work harder to throw the ball, whereas Brady doesn't have that. Like, it's a more natural motion for Brady, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Brees had to overcompensate for what his physicality was.
For sure, And then having to get out of the pocket made him more susceptible to some of those bigger hits, too, which Tom Brady has not been susceptible to in his entire career. I mean, the deal he just signed is through his age 45 season, right? Like through the end of his age 45 season. And I honestly expect him to continue playing, because based on what I saw this year, even though there is a very distinct physical performance decline from Tom Brady, but the results are the same. You know what I mean? That is very interesting to me. So like his ability to throw the ball as far is pretty much the same, but obviously your reaction time is going to go down. Your vision is going to be worse there, things like that. But it's not affected his play that much, at least not insofar as winning games.
I mean, most of it won't. Like, if you put – I once was in a lab where they put eye-tracking glasses on me and had me, you know, play quarterback in their simulated field. And what you saw was my gaze was tracked. I would follow a receiver that I wanted to throw to, and if they were covered, you'd see me look the other way, and then I'd follow them. And when they showed me the data from, you know, top-level quarterbacks, what you'd see is they were following spaces on the field between people. That were telling them like what was going to develop in the future. And you know, as the passing game has gotten more quick and complex, that kind of seeing the future skill is much more important. And complexity is the experienced quarterback's friend.
Yeah, of course.
Adds to their longevity. So you've got Brady, who doesn't need to run around. Passing game's gotten more complex. That's better for him. Of course, when the defense, you know, shifts around, they're trying to confuse his perceptual skills. And, you know, you can't, like, breathe on him without getting a penalty. So all those things, like...
That's a little Tom Brady hate right there.
Like,
come on.
Add up to... No, I mean, I wrote an article in 2016 saying he'd play into his late 40s. And I think, like, the way the game has shifted favors him. And also, he's, of course, you know, like, assiduous about his cross-training and stuff in the offseason. And, like, you don't have to... There's some great... This sounds stupid, but there's, like, if you go into a doctor's office... They'll tell you, you know, if you just turn 30, they're like, well, you're not going to gain any more bone mass. How much bone mass you have is important to not getting hurt and how much muscle you can hold. So after 30, you can just slow the decline of your bone mass by doing resistance training and stuff.
Right.
That's like, I saw physiology data from Cirque du Soleil, who has like a lot of former Olympians who, you know, they're doing a huge number of performances a year.
Yeah.
They have people who were in their late 50s who hadn't started declining yet because they had kept up with physical activity and resistance training. Some of what we think of as the medical paradigm, I think, for normal people doesn't really have to apply. It's just because we, you know, like spend most of our day on our asses.
So, and a lot of, by the way, a lot of meth addicts, those Cirque du Soleil people, dead serious. They got to keep up that crazy pace. I met two of them and I was like, why are you getting out of this? They were making good money out in Vegas. And they were like, dude, the drug scene is fucking terrible. When you have to perform like that at such a high level all day and you can't miss, you're trying to stay awake at that point. So,
I haven't heard that.
The other part of that is with the Brady thing. So let's look at what a lot of people consider Patrick Mahomes to be one of, if not the best quarterback in the league right now. It's probably not true. But even if what we're talking about right now is accurate, then he either learns how to do a better job at finding those zones and stop having to use his mobility so much, or he will not play into his late 30s and 40s, right? I mean, that's the presumption. If what we're saying about Tom Brady is true, then the inverse has to be true as well, right?
Correct. I remember like Michael Vick saying, you know, one of the things he realized when he had to leave football was he had relied so much on his athleticism that he hadn't really bothered doing the like stuff that can accelerate your perceptual learning, you know, studying film and all these things. And so then he came back and that was a big problem, you know? And so I think that is the case. And you'll even see when I think of, I think it was in the 2014 World Cup, Messi ran less than any other non-goaltender because, you know, when you're have a sense of what's going to happen before it happens, you basically sprint and walk a lot. You don't have to run around like crazy. And so that's the exact same situation, is if your perceptual skills get better, you don't have to run as much. So,
yeah.
No, I was just going to say, like, if Mahomes, you know, some of the athletes that you see that have more longevity, they shift those strategies, basically.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've had this conversation in the special operations community a lot. I was talking to Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, and there are a lot of people that see the stuff or hear about the stories that happen and blah, 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 and think that your brain immediately goes to the idea that, wow, this person's reaction time is incredible, but that's not true.
Yeah.
They've thought about that moment so many times that it just happened. Right. So even before, what you're talking about with the pitchers, with reading a pitcher, this is stuff that, Bobby Bonds, Barry's dad, and Dusty Baker, they made these instructional hitting tapes back in the day, right, that talked about that. So the average hitting coach would tell you to keep your eye on the pitcher's hand, keep your eye on the ball, that whole trope, right? So what these two guys got together and made these hitting series, and what they said was pick up cues from the pitcher the whole time. So start on his glove, right? Mm-hmm. And then as he turns to the side, look at his hip. And then when he comes forward, look at his shoulder. And then when he comes forward, when he starts to throw the ball, look at his elbow. And then when he gets here, look at the ball, right? Mm. So I'm sure that's a little reductive, but the schema makes sense still. You're still trying to put together, instead of it's batching, right? You're making a module. It's you're putting four or five different behaviors together to predict an outcome. It makes a lot of sense. They didn't know they were doing it then. They were just trying to find a better way to get somebody to actually find the focal point of the ball. But what they were doing, they were training people to do exactly what the fuck you're talking about there. It's fascinating how that happens.
Yeah, again, you know, another example where the coaches who have, you know, a lot of incentive to succeed will land on this stuff, and then the sports scientists kind of explain and magnify it.
Right, yeah. That's the problem, though, with greatness, because Kwame Brown's a good example of this. Not just Jordan trying to teach another person to play basketball, that'll never fucking work. That's like Ted Williams trying to teach somebody to hit. Ted Williams actually got signed for a couple of years as a consulting hitting coach, and he was like, just hit the ball, man. What are you doing? Like, well, Ted, it doesn't really work. Not everybody's Jesus on the baseball field, guy. We can't do that. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think it does take a partnership between science, and we're seeing it now, right? Especially in baseball. Yeah. You were right about that. With the launch angle and the spin rate and all this other bullshit that's going on right now, these have become – I mean – for all Bill James did with the data analysis to tell us what type of player might be good, for the player themselves, right, to be good. Like, you can figure shit out in the aggregate, right? I can figure out, Billy Bean can figure out over enough time, if I take more pitches, we will win more games. But that doesn't help you in a 7-game series. You know what I mean? That's why Oakland never got out of the first round of the fucking playoffs, and never would under any circumstances unless they started to spend money on players. But teaching your players the physical skills, right, to do that particular part of the job better, you know, you have to have both. You can't just rely on one. I think that was the big failure. That's why when the Red Sox started putting all of Billy Bean's learnings into practice, they started dominating in the mid-2000s because they also had the talent, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you definitely – yeah. The talent is primary importance, no question about it. And, I mean, you know, I think you're getting at something that's sort of like – a couple of years ago, an NBA team asked me to recommend somebody for a position they were going to call sports science coordinator. Mm-hmm. You know, they just wanted someone who would track the best in sports science and bring it to the court. And I made some recommendations of people I thought would be able to investigate questions and translate them well. And they decided, not that they should have listened to me at all, I'm sure they were asking a ton of people for recommendations. But they decided to go with someone who was a very decorated scientist in the lab. Mm-hmm. That lasted 1 year because that person came in and said, like, here are the findings, you know, implement. You're like, no, you need someone that realizes the coach is the decision maker who has to figure out what small amount of this actually works into the stuff that we actually do,
right,
with our actual human players. And so they got rid of that after 1 year and got someone who was much more of like a hybrid you know, of a coach and someone who could understand the science, because it is that, you know, who can help where the rubber meets the road, because exactly, some of the sort of the easiest stuff is that looking at analytics and do selection. The harder is, how can we actually make individuals better?
Exactly, right? That's what I was talking about. Like, you can definitely look at wins above replacement and what the key KPIs within that algorithm are.
Yeah.
But let's just to go back to that one example, taking more pitches will absolutely lead to more wins over a 162-game season. Not going to work in 7 games. So learning that taking more pitches will benefit the team does not help the player take pitches more. It doesn't improve their selectivity. It doesn't improve their eye for the ball, or whatever you want to call it, right? You still have to do this other part. It's too bad that didn't work, because, I mean, to be honest, I don't understand why. I'm sure teams are definitely doing this to some degree, but league-wide studies have not been very popular, and I don't know why, man. I mean, it ultimately, like I said, football and baseball and basketball, hockey, all these things, they are a television show, and they are meant to sell advertising. That's why these guys get paid a lot of money to do it. That's why we can build these giant stadiums and go to them and have a great time and everybody enjoy it and all this stuff. It's a very mutually beneficial situation. But if you start to put regulations in the way or box out new tech, right? This is anytime anybody tries to box out creative destruction and create monopolies, we've seen it before in the early fucking 20th century. The internet took 30 to 40 more years to develop than it should have, because assholes at AT&T would not open up tech to people, right? They monopolized it, and the government was complicit in all this shit. You can read all this, by the way, in The Master Switch by Tim Wu. It's a great book.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was thinking about another book where I read about that same thing by a guy named James Besson, who he wrote about that AT&T story too.
What's it called?
Gosh, hold on. It's a little more academic. Hold on, let me see.
Well, I'm fine with that.
What he's saying is, it's too smart for you, dummy.
I know. He's talking a lot of shit over here.
Very, very close.
I was just, it's called learning by doing.
Learning by doing.
The real connection between innovation, wages, and wealth. I just wanted listeners to know what they were signing up for. Look, that's all.
Yeah, no, look, I get it. We're too stupid. You're smarter than us. I understand all of it. My question, David, is, How come you haven't taken the juice there? You know the cocktail. You know the perfect formula to make a dope body. Like, That your body's not great.
Yeah,
it's
just low key insulted his body. Now to get back for him calling us dumb or what was that?
No, look, you're a thinner guy. I don't know how you're doing it at that age. It's amazing. You've clearly biohacked something. You know that you're not a fat piece of shit, which is awesome. But any thoughts on jacking it up and maybe going to like a Canseco body just because you can and you have all the info?
You know, when I was doing reporting on drugs and sports, I got a lot of prescriptions for drugs because I was trying to figure out like where everybody was doing stuff. So I had some prescriptions and I thought about that from time to time, but I was a Division I 800 meter runner, and so being as big as possible was sort of never on my agenda because it's a lot harder to run the way that I like to run if you're too big. So I just wasn't, you know, I just wasn't sort of oriented that way. And I don't like having like too many things to do and keep track of and stuff like that.
Yeah, you're not going to be counting. Like for somebody of your size, if you really wanted to bulk up, you're going to be eating 5,000 to 7,000 calories a day. Fuck that. All of that.
Speaking of that, for most people, like they can... You know, people think about this stuff that like elite athletes are doing, like that's the high hanging fruit. Like most people should get their diet and their exercise in order first before they're thinking about any of that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So plenty of low hanging fruit, you know, I still work on. And I don't like to, you know, I was at ProPublica doing some investigative reporting on medicine. And one of my conclusions was I don't really want to mess around with medicine unless I, you know, feel really strongly about it.
Right.
Well, look, I'm just saying for the ladies, you married, David?
Yes, I am.
Okay. You know, and if you weren't, I didn't know. I didn't see a ring on one of those hands. I didn't know if you were. I would be like, if you're a single guy for the ladies, why not take a couple injections and take shit to the next level? Like that would be rad.
Are you talking to me or you talking to yourself? Both. I'm trying to figure out what's going on here.
Both. Like I've talked about this numerous times on this show. I'd love the perfect cocktail and doctor it'd be a one-stop shop, right? I could go get my steroids, be my best possible self, do exactly the workout I need to do in the exact amount of time. Like the perfect time for me would be about 48 minutes, right? Get all my injections, all my shit. Yeah, I'm a busy guy, David. I do, you know, 125 shows a month.
I don't think he was commenting on the length of the workout, just the specificity. 48 is pretty exact. What do you got, 12 minutes to do something else?
Yes, and you know what that something else is.
Yeah, it's pounding off. Yeah, I know
exactly. Yeah. It's twice a day. You know, 6 minutes a piece. That's fine. Like I can reload, and you know, one in the morning, one at night, and then having sex somewhere like right after dinner. If I could go in for a 48-minute workout, get all jacked up by the doctors, you know, get a bunch of syringes, but all the clean shit, like the good shit, that like a Ryan Reynolds is on, you know, for Deadpool, for example, right? Then, you know, I could live my life, enjoy my day, and be the best human I could possibly be. I think I'd be a happier person. The world would be better for it, and everybody would be hot.
But I think what he's challenging is the perception that everybody needs the same body. If he wants to be a runner, for example, most tier one operators are not large. They don't look like me. They look more like Giorgio. They're like very thin guys. They're between 5'7" often, is that low, to 5'10" or 5'11", maybe 5'11". You rarely over 6 feet tall will you see a tier one operator. And it's because they're endurance athletes, ultimately. That's what they are. They have to be able to go do that at a high level for a very long period of time.
Yeah, I mean, the body you want definitely determines on depends on what it is you want to do with that body. So so my question would be...
He wants to look good and slam ass, so that's why he wants the big muscles.
Yes!
So if you're saying that you would be a happier person doing that, have you been pursuing it? I mean, are you looking? Are you investigating?
So like, I'm on TRT right now, and our doctor that Dan and I use, Dr. Frank, is probably going to stop down later tonight, Dan, and we'll try to pop off another interview with him for some updates. My T... level was low, like right on the number, you know, where it was just like, holy shit, you're crashing. And I couldn't figure out what was going on, right? So I take testosterone shots once a week, right, on Mondays. I still would like to kick that up another level to where it's like, hey man, you're just shredded all the time. Like I want to go old school, like 78 Allman Brothers. I'm not wearing shirts anywhere, like at the fucking grocery store or whatever. I want my shirt to be like a mask, where I want people to stop me and be like, sir, you need to put your shirt on if you're going to shop here. The same way somebody's going to tell me to put my fucking mask on these days. I want to be that guy.
So you want to be Jeff Spicoli, like, from Fast Times at Ridgemont High is what you're saying?
100%.
Yeah, I get it.
However, the only way to do that at this age, and again, I don't have a lot of time throughout the day. We do 125 shows a month on this network. And then I write at night, also a New York Times bestselling author as well. David, even though you called me a fucking dummy earlier.
That was nothing about that.
I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. I'm going to get a bumper sticker. David Epstein didn't kill himself. But that's where I'm at, where I'm a busy dude. Is that possible in the future that we're going to get that, like a one-stop shop, like a fucking pill or just an injection?
It's still have to be bespoke though to you, because it's not, there's no way exactly. That, like, everybody's different.
But look at a chart. You'd be like, all right, you want Ryan Reynolds and Deadpool? Do you want the Momoa shots? You know, do you want to be Aquaman, kind of bulky, but maybe ride a motorcycle?
What if you want McConaughey and Dallas Buyers Club though? You know, well, what I mean? The shot for that, I believe, is heroin.
Yeah, that's a little too thin. But you know, is that possible, David? Are we heading that route eventually?
I mean, if we start, you know, moving through the world with our digital avatars, this could be like much more easy, much more quickly than you think.
That's right? True. Like, we could go full. You remember that movie Gamer with Gerard Butler, where this is fat fucks sitting in chairs, leaned back, but their avatars hot. So hey, let's do this.
G-butts. Yeah, G-butts. Great example. He was in 300. All those guys were all
up on steroids. That was all airbrushed in, all those abs.
They were later, but they still had to do some form of working out and all that other stuff. But yeah, man, I had this conversation because there was a gym in Austin that was like a new wave type shit where they hook you up with
New Fit,
those
yeah.
pads. Yes, New Fit. You know, they hook you up with those pads and they shock the shit out of you. You know what I'm talking about, David?
Yep.
Yeah. So, I was going there for like a few months, right? And it worked. I was getting I was sore as fuck, and I was getting the shit like shocked out of me. And I talked to somebody there, and I was like, what's the eventual dream of this? And they were like, man, if you could add a clinic onto this and then, you know, take whatever you needed to take, buy a doctor, obviously, super healthy, and then do some of this shit, you'd be styling at that point. Are we near it?
You know, I don't think we're near the, like, give me the Ryan Reynolds and Deadpool injection. but in a way, yeah, I mean, for sure, there were, when I was investigating these clinics, a lot of them were around Hollywood, right? Because people would say things like that, essentially, right? It's the same as when they go to, like, your surgeons say, like, after Adrian Peterson, everyone's like, I want the surgery that he had.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it happened with Tommy John surgery, right? After Tommy John.
And so I think, you know, there's not that long ago, someone of your age and presumed health profile would not have been having TRT, right? So we're obviously like moving in a direction where that
well, like you said, it's the prescriptions for plus 40 people have quintupled, you said, since 2010. So over the last 10 years?
I think it was between like 2000, 2010, thereabouts.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's definitely, you see it all over the place now. And it's, I don't know why it was so controversial for so long, frankly. It seemed weird. So I was in the military, and in the military, so when I got out, right when I got out in 2010, I got my TRT tested. It was part of a traumatic brain injury panel, and it was 180, which I don't know what you know about that, but that's fucking low as shit. That's like, that's what, double what the high end of a female would be, somewhere around there. So that's not great. And I was 28 and a half, 29 years old at the time. But the first test I did right before, like it was a year before that, it was at like 345. And I think 340 was the normal. So 340 to 830 was the normal range. That is a massive range. It doesn't take a demographic, including age, into account at all. And I don't know why it was like that for so long. It was very bizarre. I don't know if it was the blowback from, like, Lyle Salzado, for example, getting cancer and his heart exploding or whatever the fuck happened with him. That was a big deal. And then, obviously, the baseball stuff that happened. I wonder if that's what it is. Because, really, we're just talking about what can we do to unlock human potential. You know what I mean? So, the Tommy John surgery, actually, the new research on that shows that, because there's this perception that getting the Tommy John surgery makes you throw faster than you used to. But it's not true. It just repairs all the shit you've damaged over the last 10 to 20 years of throwing a baseball. So it brings you back to where you should have been in the first place. So our bodies are probably meant, before all this processed food and all this stupid, all the hormones and antibiotics we get exposed to in our food chain, there's a good chance that our body was supposed to be there originally, and we fucked it up. And now we're just correcting what was you know, done to us by commercial farming and stuff like that. So I don't understand why it's so fucking controversial.
I mean, it's well, I think it's clearly getting less controversial.
Certainly now, yes.
Which is why you've seen those, you know, and that stuff just takes time. I mean, one of the reasons I think it was so controversial, honestly, is because, you know, to some degree, like, athletes would get caught, you know, starting like in the 80s, but then up through Congress.
Right.
Instead of saying, like, I don't understand why this is so controversial, they would say, I would absolutely never do that because all the children would be corrupted and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think a lot of athletes who did not think it was controversial went in very public places and made it seem controversial. And so actually, I think that was one of the not so great outcomes of, you know, that kind of grandstanding that occurred.
Right. Well, so. Congress, that's all they do is grandstand. So I don't
know. Yeah, I mean, they get positive feedback for doing that. So
yeah, well, they keep doing it. By positive feedback, I assume you mean attention. More and attention. Reelected. Yeah. Yeah.
But awesome. That's interesting. You mentioned that processed food thing. I'm not like just trying to plug my own thing here, but the episode we have coming out tomorrow on how to is by James Nestor, who just wrote a book on science of breathing.
Yep.
Yeah.
And one of the things he mentioned that I didn't know about at all was that if you look at like skulls of our ancestors, they have straight teeth because before processed food, when you had to chew a lot, your bone and muscle in your face strengthened and your face became broader. And so your teeth came in straight. And now that since we're growing up more on processed food, our faces end up growing a little smaller than they should. And our teeth come in all crooked. And so he's got me chewing this like leathery kind of gum and stuff. I just thought that was fascinating.
Oh, you're not cruising around with that little rubber ring that I see those dudes on like chewing on the internet. I'm like, dude, what are you practicing for?
No, what's happening? It's just normal gum. It's just like harder at first.
Wait, what kind of gum is it? Plug the gum too, man. Since you plugged your own shit, you're not going to plug the gum that's saving your life? Are you kidding me?
Plug the
gum.
Save
my life. I've been chewing this gum for a week.
It's just
the kind that James recommends. It's this Turkish gum called Falim.
Oh, cool.
Okay. But people are getting smaller heads. Smaller faces.
Yeah.
Man, there's got to be a study between that and Antifa. I just saw that that huge mugshot list of all the Antifa people. Super tiny faces and eyes close together. Like that was a weird one too.
I call them tine heads.
Like yeah.
Tiny head. Yeah. Tiny head folks. Yeah. But it's not, I don't think it's political. It's just some people.
No, not at all. It's just, those are the people that, I think they're attracted to one another because of the head size. And then they decide to go for something big, you know, where it's like, hey,
how important is head size to you? If you don't mind me asking.
To me?
No, well, to both of you. Yeah, that question's for both of you. Like, if you were choosing a partner, does head size come into play? Obviously, if it was grotesque in one way or the other, it's going to come into play. But if otherwise reasonably attractive woman, if she had a smaller head than you were used to, would that affect whether? I wonder about that. You know, I wonder about a lot of things.
Yeah, David, I'll start with me. And that way you can decide how uncomfortable you want to take this, right? For me personally, my wife has smaller teeth. And I know that sounds weird. They're just above a baby tooth where it's not a baby, but it's, you know, it's a woman. But if they were a little smaller, I wouldn't have married her. And I told her about it. And I was like, have you heard that before in your life? She goes, actually, I have. Yes. Like, I have these tiny teeth and I just made it. You know what I'm saying?
Made it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and say I have never spent a moment consciously thinking about that.
Oh yeah, I've thought about it a lot. So with her, I told her, I was like, look, if those teeth were any smaller, you'd start to get into a danger zone for me, where it's like, man, very pedophile. It almost looked like, to a point where I was gonna ask, like, have your baby teeth fallen out yet? I met her when she was like 30.
And so my guess is that she didn't just say, like, in that conversation with like, gosh, I'm lucky my teeth aren't any smaller. What did she have to say about you?
Yeah, exactly. She probably called him a cunt, to be honest.
Yeah, she's super funny. She actually fessed up to the baby tooth thing. She was like, yeah, dude, I was this, like, she goes, I was like, you know, I don't know what you measure. I think it's centimeters or it's not a millimeter, obviously. It's way too big. I'm not a scientist, never claimed to be, never played one on television. But whatever that little nth is more, if it was that less, it should have been in a weird category of like, holy shit, do you still have all your baby teeth? And she admitted to it. She was like, yes. But then she went into some other shit with dudes where she was like, small hands. She goes, tiny hands I can't get into for a dude. And that, you know, that's a strange thing as well. Like, we've all got our thing where it's just like, all right, shit.
Mine's actually people's names and their voice, because
their names.
Yeah. So here's the deal, David, Mr. Epstein, Stein. Is it Steen or Stein? I never get that right.
Steen.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Do what you like.
Yeah. Well, it's America. I don't want to be lying in bed at 80 years old next to someone with named Gertrude that sounds like a fucking truck stop waitress. That's going to be a problem for me, because all this other physical shit is going away. We're all going to look like fat fucking old bitches at some point, right? We're going to have varicose veins. We're going to lose all of our hair color, some of our hair. Our eyes are going to fade, all that stuff. So the things that I'm going to, I'll probably be deaf by then, so the voice won't come into play that much, but I just don't want to be able to have to, I don't want to have to say a name I don't like over and over.
Because that's going to stay and all that other stuff fades.
Correct.
I have to say, you guys have very well defined, like, you have really homed in on, like, the things that are important to you. That's.
Well, I smoke a lot of weed. That's my problem. I don't even know what the fuck's going on right now, to be honest.
And David, I'm going to be real with you. We had a talk about this. We were super fucked up the other night. Not that it's a huge shock on a show called Drinking Bros. We were super rocked the other night, and we talked about sexuality as it's changed throughout the years based on what we're seeing, like, celebrity wise.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, fat asses, for example, right? On the come up as a young man, a fat ass was never my thing. It just wasn't, man. That was not at the top of my list, where I was like, I was a tits guy. And then it slowly shifted over the years into fat asses. And, like, I found myself dating, you know, more and more people that were living up to that standard. And then I married a girl that's just a great fat ass.
I like how this conversation for the first, like, hour and 10 minutes or so, or hour and 5 minutes, was, like, super scientific, and now we're just talking about fat asses. What happened?
This went off the rails completely. scientific, I'm not... and I'll ask you why, David. Does that come into play psychology-wise when, like, over the years, if you're seeing the same thing over and over and over again, or shit is constantly thrown in your face, does it change your perception and things that you taste and things like that as they develop over the years? Is like last night, I was one of like 10 people watching the Grammys, apparently. And then they did a live performance of Wet Ass Pussy with Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, right? I'd never really thought of Megan Thee Stallion as that attractive until last night. And then she got out there and I was like, all right, bullshit. There was different elements that I've never seen before, partially because she was performing almost nude. But is that a thing that's going on in psychology, like in today's society?
I don't know. I think it's clearly, like, there are aspects of perception of beauty and attraction that have changed over history, but I have no idea what the psychology specifically has to say about that. And at the risk of at the risk of you thinking I'm trying to insult you again, which I wasn't before, I was like, you know what, my wife, I'm like, she's a lot smarter than I am. That's going to be good in the long run. And I'm trying to think about it. I'm not even sure I know that much about her teeth, to be honest.
Okay. Okay. So let's take this, right? Because you're a really fucking smart dude. Clearly, how is your wife smarter than you? Like, what were her stats? Harvard? What did she graduate in? Like, all that shit. Yeah. Like, how is she smarter than you? That seems crazy.
No, it's not that crazy. Come on. There's a lot of smart people out there. But yeah, no, I mean, she went to Harvard, but that's not why, like, I think she's smart. It was just like, you know, I had, like, trouble keeping up with her.
Right.
And she was, like, very, not just smart, but, like, wanted to, like, do stuff that other people would be like, that's not going to work because. And she was like, no, I'll handle it. You know, I'll make it work. And I just thought that was super cool. And she's turned out, as I thought, to be, like, very sort of entrepreneurial and always starting stuff. And, it's like, what, marry up,
right?
You know,
that was the motivation behind doing stuff is, it says a lot about you as a person, though, right? Like, if your motivation is small teeth, for example, you're probably a piece of shit. I mean, let's be real. Ross is a piece of shit, and everybody knows it, man. That's half of the show, but so am I. So are we all.
Yeah.
You just got to find out how you're a piece of shit and work around it. That's
exactly
my life.
What city do you live in, David?
I live in D.C.
Okay, cool. Because I want to make sure that my kids don't go to school with yours. They will fuck up the bell curve. If your wife is smarter than you, holy shit, your children are going to, I mean, at the, just bell curve destroyers for the rest of their lives. Do you have any kids?
I do. I have a 2-year-old.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So I get a 2-year-old as well, right? And I'm honest about, you know, the long-term expectations for them. Great-looking kids. Wife's hot. Kids are good-looking. But they'd get, you know, just drilled in a science fair against your kids in like fucking third grade. You know, I don't want any part of that.
This is very reminiscent of a conversation that happened between one of your friends and Tucker Carlson. Do you remember writing about that a couple of years ago? About what's
David?
Her name? David.
Oh, about one of my friends and Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean about Joanna Harper?
Yes. Where she said your kids are probably not going to be very good runners, for example.
Yeah, that was funny. Yeah. Joanna is a medical physicist and a trans woman who was an age group champion as a runner and went on Tucker Carlson to talk about transgender athletes. And at some point he was talking about, you know, would transgender athletes like ruin the competition for some girls? And Joanna said, like, well, as I understand it, you're like a 27-minute 5K runner, so I don't think your progeny will have to worry about this. And he was like,
yeah, he got a good kick out of that. That was really funny, actually. Yeah. He's not getting a good kick out of the press he's getting right now, though. I don't think.
It is what it is. There's other fucked up things going on in the world, or maybe he is, dude. His ratings are probably through the goddamn roof. I know that I'm watching the Cuomos just to see what happens to homeboy up in New York, you know, and what the brother's going to say about it.
Yeah.
It all varies. What's your end game, David? What's your ultimate dream that you haven't tackled yet?
My ultimate dream that I haven't tackled yet. Ooh, I don't know. Like to go to space. You know, I used to want to be a fighter pilot and an astronaut. And that looks like it's increasingly receding from possibility, but I don't know. I mean, these books, like, you know, taken on, like, I didn't expect Bill Gates to be like blurbing or writing about my book and stuff like that. So I'm still sort of find it crazy that this shit I get curious about, a lot of other people seem to be curious about. And so that's why I'm kind of dabbling in a podcast right now, you know, and I'm sure there'll be other books, but I'm sort of an exploratory phase right now. But I always get obsessed about what I think are like mistranslations of science to the public. And those start me down some, you know, a line of some project. And I think I'll keep doing that for a while.
Nice. Do you write to music?
I don't write music. I love music. I don't write
music. Write to music.
No, write to it.
Do I write to music? I sometimes do. If I'm like really trying to focus in, though, and I think this has to do with like that sort of, you know, occupying my prefrontal cortex. Yeah. If I really need to focus in, I won't listen to music with words. If I'm sort of, if I only need to be like, if I don't need to be like totally locked in, I can listen to music. But if I need to be totally locked in, then it's probably.
So you're listening to music without words. Is it like classical, or are you listening to like, you know, trance music or some shit like that, like techno?
Could be anything. Doesn't really. Yeah. Well, probably not techno. I think that would be a little. If I'm trying to get locked in, that might be a little bit distracting.
Daft Punk is a little lighter.
Know, like movie. There's some good like movie soundtracks for that, right? Like you don't want anything that's like stuff that's like pretty typical harmony, right? Because it's not like requiring any of your processing power to like listen to what's going on.
Yeah, my
Zimmer.
Yeah, Hans
I bet
Zimmer.
You're a Zimmer guy. Are you a Hans Zimmer guy?
I would totally listen to like the Gladiator soundtrack.
Oh, know, yeah, that was like that's the one that popped in my head too. Yeah, that's a good one. But my brain first went to popular songs with the lyrics removed, but I think your brain would still be trying to sing the lyrics in your head if you recognize the melody. So it would have to be something completely distinct.
Yeah, and I mean, I will turn it. One thing I'll find too is if I'm listening to it over and over and over and over again, then it kind of like fades away anyway. But sometimes too, if I really want to be locked in, I'll turn the music off for a little while, even though it's not as much fun.
Yeah. By the way, Hans Zimmer played Coachella 2 years ago. Imagine taking hard drugs and seeing that for fucking an hour and a half.
No, we actually had a similar experience, but it was more the surrealness. It wasn't the incredible nature of the music. So we were at a charity golf tournament in September with Kid Rock, John Daly, and Rob O'Neill, and some other people. And it's late in the day. We'd been drinking all day. And all of a sudden, Proud to Be an American comes on. Like, there's a band there, and they started playing Proud to Be an American, and we're like, what the fuck? So Ross turned around, and it was actually Lee Greenwood, the guy that wrote the song. Nobody knew he was there. Wow. That had me fucked up for about 2 weeks. I couldn't figure out what was real.
Same. You know I mean? Started crying. I didn't even know why. I mean, I just, who knows? I literally walked out. Imagine, because I thought it was like a karaoke thing, right? Somebody was singing it, and I was like, God damn, that dude's good. So I popped on out, and I was like, holy shit, it's really Lee Greenwood. I think it was definitely a combination of the sun that I had taken, you know, all day long, and then maybe 14 or 15 cocktails consumed. But I started crying, and I tweeted about it, and Lee hit me up, and he was like, man, I appreciate it. I appreciate that you were emotional to that, so he's going to come on the show. But, you know, there's certain songs that trigger all that shit. I don't think you believe me about the Hans Zimmer thing. That's true, by the way. If you go look up his performance at Coachella on YouTube after the show's over, it'll alter your mind. You're like, oh, fuck. He played the Gladiator thing at Coachella.
Oh, shit, okay. Really?
Dude, all of his huge hits from all of his movies, he played in a row. It was like, I think it was an hour and 20 minutes. And people were blotto. I mean, out of their mind on drugs. And then hearing all their favorite movie scores, you were like, oh, shit. But the Gladiator one he played that night.
That would be pretty incredible.
I know. I wish I was there.
Yeah. I'll definitely check that out.
It sounded weird at first. And then I was like, yeah. And then I popped it on and I was like, oh, shit, dude. Zimmer just pounded out hits. There was no B-sides from Zimmer. It was all shit you knew, you know? It was all shit you knew. This is the point in the show, David. We get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the person you are today. Who would you like to give the drinking bro of the week to?
Oh, who's inspired me? Who I'm going to be? You know, I want to give it to, Malcolm Gladwell, who in my first book became a bestseller in large part because I was criticizing him. Then we became running and workout buddies. And his approach to our disagreements, I think, set a tone that I've carried through the rest of my career for how to learn from my own critics. And I've never really told him that in the same way, but I really appreciate that.
That's happened quite a bit to you, it seems, because I've read a lot of your work over the last couple of days to get ready for this. And it seems like a lot of people that you've had, not I wouldn't say antagonistic relationships, but certainly counter viewpoints where you're openly debating these people become lifelong friends of yours. You know what I mean?
They've been the best.
Yeah.
So the most interesting, generative, like professional relationships I've had have often been people that I've had like very stark disagreements with.
Yeah.
And he was one of the first of those. And I think I've become good at that partly because of sort of the tone he set. Like the first time we ever met was a debate at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, founded by Daryl Morey. And it's on YouTube. People can go see the debate. And he said, you know, you made some points. Let's go run together tomorrow.
Right.
I think that just set a tone that I've carried through my career.
Well, I mean, it's good. We need more of that for sure. It's one of the things I love about the conversations between Eric Weinstein and Douglas Murray. If you ever watch or listen to Portals, Weinstein's podcast, some of those, because they could not be more different as human beings. There's no, I mean, I guess they could be different races, but they could not be at least ideologically more different.
And I think ability to learn from your critics is a massively underrated skill.
Well, one of the things people say is I can't remember where the quote comes from. I have to look it up sometime, but it's essentially speak as if you know you're right, but listen as if you know you're wrong, right? I think it's a good way to do, because if you speak as if you know you're right, then you're putting out exactly what you believe and why. You're not trying to customize it to the audience. You're saying exactly what you believe. And if you listen like you're wrong, then you're hearing them with grace. You're hearing them. You're assuming the best of what they're saying, right?
Yeah.
And giving it the same shot that you would give your own stuff. So I think it's an important thing.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Malcolm Gladwell real quick before we get out of here. What's his sitch in real life? Is he a cool guy or is he pretty intense?
Very cool guy. I mean, he's intense in certain ways. Like he is, I feel like he is who you would probably guess he is from all of his work, which is you throw out an idea, he throws out some angle you haven't thought of, right? Like you can be like this, that like intersection that we just ran through, that intersection sucks. It annoys me every day. And he's like, you know, that's because of this like traffic pattern thing, like five blocks downstream that happened for like some, you know, reason that I don't know about. And so he's just like playful with ideas. I think he's very much like who you would think he is from all the stuff he does publicly and in his work, like in his own time.
Yeah, because I remember,
he's,
you know,
I track nerd. I'll say he's like the biggest running nerd like I've ever met.
Wow.
I'm a Prefontaine fan myself. So, you know, RIP, obviously, but lost a bet to D'Anthony on the show here. Had to dye my hair blonde and grow the mustache. Lasted about 6 months. Yeah, dead serious.
Yeah. I'm more of an Oscar Pretorius fan, to be honest, but whatever.
Ah, oh, little ting ting, dude.
Don't lose the bet there, I guess.
No, I'd get my legs cut off. Fuck.
And I'd be in prison for shooting my girlfriend on Valentine's Day. The 10,000 hours thing is kind of bullshit, though, right? I know that's probably what he's most famous for. But you ever done something for 10,000 hours? Probably writing for you, and same with me. And I was just like, hey, man, I felt like I mastered that a long time before that. But what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've probably written for 10,000 hours, or at least like thought about writing for 10,000 hours. But if to the extent that Malcolm meant a lot of practice is important to become great, and often more than people think, fine. But that actual 10,000 hours came from this tiny violin study.
Right, yeah.
Where basically nobody actually did 10,000 hours. It was like an average. Some people went over, some people went under. It was an average of these enormous individual differences that actually tells you nothing about how people reach expertise. So
it's a mean median mode discrepancy then, ultimately, right?
I mean, that was one of the problems with it. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild. Well, look, give him a shout out. Obviously, I'm sure he'd love to match my brilliant mind someday. I'm just totally kidding. David, tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find me at davidepstein.com. I write the Range Report. It's something new that I started there. Just a free newsletter. And I'm the new host of Slate's How To podcast. So if you got some problem you want us to work on, just write into it. And if it's a really interesting problem, we'll take it up.
Sweet. What kind of problems do you guys typically deal with there? Is it everything across the board?
Yeah, it could really be anything. I mean, I was interviewing someone today that was like, you know, I mentioned earlier it was about choking, like how not to choke was the first episode I did. I was interviewing someone today about like how to survive when you're lost at sea, you know, so it can range from like the pretty unlikely to the like everyday, you know, how not to choke in your office to how to survive things that probably won't actually happen to you.
Anything like super intense or super disgusting where you're like, holy shit, I can't believe that one?
I mean, I've only been doing it for a couple episodes, but some of them are definitely intense. Like somebody wanted to, you know, had a bunch of family deaths, like in the pandemic, wanted to know about like how to write obituaries for their own family members. And, you know, like people who became estranged from, like there was one episode that went viral. This was when Charles Duhigg, the author of Power of Habit, was the host before I was the host. He had one where this woman's father wrote to her and was like, lose my phone number, don't talk to me, you know. And it was like, how do you deal with like a parent who for like no real logical reason like wants to become estranged from you? So some of them are pretty intense, some of them are just funny and goofy, and some of them are pretty intense.
Okay, cool. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, check that out.
Yeah, there's a lot of craziness out in the world. I mean, look, we've done somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 episodes on this show, so yeah. I mean, fuck yeah, if you were gonna do a how-to with like Tiana Trump, for example.
Yeah, you don't want to do that one.
Yeah, it's going to be a long night. You're going to learn a lot. She is a porn star, in case you were not familiar. But
she's not familiar.
Yeah. She broke down how to give like the world's best blowjob, and like to a T. And then she was like, "You can find it on Twitter," and she actually posts videos there. Where I didn't know that about her. You know what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying. And when you're the host of How To, I will that might not be an episode of How To until you're hosting.
Well, give them my resume and then what I just told you and see if they're interested. I'm totally kidding. No, it's fucking hilarious. David, you're a great guy, great sport. It was great being with you. We appreciate your time today. Look, check out his books. How many bestsellers do you got on New York Times?
I've written two books and they've both been bestsellers, The Sports Gene and Range.
Wow. So that's two guests in a row, because we had Maria Konnikova on yesterday. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
She's one of my favorite. She's a good friend. Talked to her yesterday.
Oh, really? Yeah. So we recorded with her last week. The show went out last night. She is really fucking smart. We had a great conversation with her. Really enjoyed it.
Were you guys talking poker?
Sociology and psychology and a little bit of poker, yeah.
Yeah, yep. She's amazing.
She really is. Yeah.
She's of all my friends, she's, you know, so in her, whatever, she was like investigating risk taking and focus and all this, and sort of accidentally became a pro poker, not accidentally, she became a pro poker player. She didn't know like how many cards were in a deck before she became a pro. Right. She's absolutely my least, of all my friends, the person I'm the least surprised at would go from like knowing nothing to being a poker pro in a year. So that's a good summary of her.
I bet your dinner parties are wild, dude. It's just, It's very, very heady.
Yeah, my two-year-old, he is, whoo.
Smashing peas up on the plate.
As you know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a blast. Check out David, check out his books on Amazon, check out his podcast. We appreciate you being here. For David Epstein, D'Anthony Holloway, I'm Ross Patterson. This is The Drinking Bros. Good night.